Chapter 3, Current Potential Threats. In addition to talking regularly with local law enforcement, you're going to want to be observant of whether or not criminals are currently active in your particular area. As an example, if you start seeing a big increase in graffiti in your neighborhood, it could indicate gang activity, or it could simply be taggers. If you want to learn more about gang graffiti and how to tell the difference between simple vandals and gang members, I suggest that you go over to Robert Walker's site called gangsorus.com and quickly watch a 2-minute video that he's got there on gang graffiti deciphering. For now, just watch the 2-minute video and bookmark the page so that you can go back when you're done with this chapter. That URL again is gangsorus.com/graffiti.html, and graffiti is spelled G-R-A-F-F-I-T-I, and I'll have a link to it on the resource page for this chapter. You can also view all the crimes that your local law enforcement is reporting by going to one of these two sites, crimereports.com, or if your city does not share data with crimereports.com, try spotcrime.com. On crimereports.com, I suggest clicking on the crime types button and selecting violent crimes. Then pick the 30-day option. This will quickly show you all the violent crimes committed in your area in the last 30 days, as reported by your local law enforcement.
In the upper right-hand corner of the map, it will tell you how many crimes are being shown. Crimereports.com will show a maximum of 500 crimes on a given map, so make sure you zoom in so that this number is under 500. The addresses that have a teal blue box are addresses where multiple incidents have happened in the last 30 days. If there are areas with multiple teal blue boxes, consider marking them on your map.
Accidents, terrorist targets, and natural disasters. Take a look at your map or a map online if you don't have your map handy, and locate the railroad tracks in your area. If you are within a mile of the tracks, you need to have a plan in place for rail accidents. One such incident happened on January 6, 2005 at 2:40 in the morning, when two trains collided in Graniteville, South Carolina. They caused 90 tons of chlorine gas to be released into the air. Since it was the middle of the night, there were 5,400 residents sleeping within 1 mile of the accident. And of those 5,400 residents, 9 people died of chlorine inhalation and 250 people had to be treated for chlorine exposure. Before you get too worried, I want you to put this in perspective. There are only 5 to 10 rail crashes a year in the U.S., and the Graniteville crash is the worst one since 2005. Most deaths in rail accidents happen because of the actual crash and not because of chemicals released into the air. That being said, in addition to accidents, Arabic terrorist websites have been promoting the use of homemade thermite to cut rail lines or weld debris onto rail lines in urban areas to derail trains suspected of or known to be carrying hazardous cargo. These sites are also promoting attacks on industrial chemical storage facilities. In particular, they're targeting anhydrous ammonia, hydrogen fluoride, methyl isocyanate, and chlorine. Now, these are used in making fertilizer, pharmacology, plastics. They're used in refineries, pesticides, adhesives, and rubber. So most of them are everyday things. Now, what does this mean? It means that if you live or work near a rail line, you should know that a crash or toxic leak is a possibility and decide what your response would be if a large-scale chemical release happened. It isn't likely to happen, but if it does, you may be the only person in your immediate area who has thought through what to do and who can act immediately and guide others around you. Fortunately, your preparations for this scenario will also carry over to more mundane and likely threats of an industrial fire upwind of your location. As an example, if you hear a massive train crash half a mile upwind from you during a normal time and immediately see a cloud rising up into the air, you might want to take action by getting out of the area. If there was no explosion and you can figure that the wind is blowing straight towards you with a light breeze, let's say 10 miles an hour, you probably have 3 minutes before any of the smoke or chemicals reach you. And the best course of action is to leave in your car and tell your coworkers and neighbors to do the same. Let's say that you're directly north of the explosion. If possible, you want to escape directly to the east or west so that you will be completely out of the path of the cloud. If you remember your geometry, you want to put distance between you and the incident while traveling perpendicular to the direction of the wind. Keep in mind that your response will most likely be different if a large-scale chemical release happens during a normal time as opposed to during a local or regional emergency when travel isn't an option. If such an event does happen during a time of a general emergency, or if you aren't one of the first to evacuate and you can't anymore, you may have to survive in place. We'll be covering this in a couple of weeks, including how to create a small safe area in your home or office within minutes that will allow you to drastically increase your chances of surviving a chemical incident should one happen near you. I'll also show you some ways to cut down the amount of time that it takes to set up your safe room, cutting off 50 to 75% of the time that it normally takes. Now, you should also consider developing a similar plan if you live within a mile of a chemical manufacturing company, a refinery, fuel storage facility, or a manufacturing facility that has large stockpiles of chemicals. Start making notes of these facilities as you're driving around, and don't be afraid to ask firemen if there are any facilities near your house that you should be aware of. You can also get the locations of many of these facilities right now by using Google Maps. Simply go to maps.google.com and enter the following search. Just type in Refinery Houston and hit the return key, or whatever your city name is. Press the search maps button. You'll get back results for the actual refineries and the offices of refineries. A general tip is that if the result is in the middle of the city, it's an office. And if it's in a large open area, it's a refinery. Google has the option to do a satellite view or street level viewing. Both will let you see whether or not there's an actual refinery or not, but since you're only concerned with facilities that are in your immediate area, another option is to simply drive by and see what's there. Another search to do is this: Chemical Dealers Detroit, or again, whatever your city name is. When the results come up, look above the results on the left-hand side and click on Chemical Dealers. Most of these companies don't have a large enough quantity of chemicals on hand to be concerned about. If you have any within a mile of your house or where you work, drive by someday and see if they have large outdoor tanks. If they do, mark them on your map. If you don't know whether or not they're a danger, just put a question mark on your map. If you know what the chemical is, go ahead and write that down. This can be especially important if you live in an earthquake-prone area. If you have an earthquake and need to get home from your place of work quickly, you would do well to avoid facilities that may be leaking irritating or harmful chemicals into the air. One last thing to be aware of if you live within a quarter mile of an interstate is hazardous cargo routes. Like railroad accidents, hazardous cargo accidents don't happen very often, but they involve much smaller quantities of chemicals. Next time you're driving into your city, look for square signs that either say HC or HC with a line through them. They're in place to direct truck drivers on legal routes to get through a city with hazardous cargo. This section may make it sound like there are threats all around you, and there are, but to put it in perspective, please go to the following site, and I'll have a link to it on the resource page. It's hazmat.globalincidentmap.com, and click on the Here button in the lower right-hand corner. You can see a map of all the hazardous material incidents in the U.S. for the last 30 days. You'll see the number of true chemical or non-fuel incidents is incredibly small. There are more gas spills on highways and meth houses than there are large-scale chemical accidents. I want to bring this to your attention so that you don't waste undue time and money preparing for a large-scale chemical release that probably won't happen or even affect you. For most people, it's enough to know that the threat exists, to work through a plan so that you know what to do if you see or hear an accident or are asked to evacuate. Points of interest in the event of civil breakdown. Hurricane Katrina showed us firsthand what can happen in the U.S. in an urban area after a major disaster when order breaks down. We're going to cover survival lessons from Katrina in depth, but for today, I just want to go over one thing. Avoid large groups of people in need. Avoid refugees. In particular, avoid stadiums, homeless shelters, schools, auditoriums, any area designated as a Red Cross shelter, hospitals, refugee areas, and churches. Yes, even churches. After Katrina, many churches were forced by the city to provide services to whoever the city brought to them. This was fine when the churches had food, toiletries, and the plumbing worked. But it wasn't fine when the plumbing stopped working and the city wouldn't let the churches send people home. It got ugly. Many crimes were committed in the churches, and many churches were horribly vandalized. Unless you're actively working at one in a relief capacity, you'll be better off avoiding the area all around these facilities. Why? Well, it's where panicked people trying to get in to the shelters will be. It's where people looking for handouts or victims will be hunting for their next mark. It's also where people who got kicked out of the facility for fighting drugs or whatever will be congregating. And it's where drug dealers will be peddling to refugees from the shelters. Your area may be different. In many parts of the Midwest and the Rockies, church members just wouldn't stand for a situation like this, and churches will be a place of refuge during and after an emergency. If an emergency happens in your area and you decide to go to a church, listen to your gut. If it doesn't feel safe as you're approaching or while you're there, leave immediately. Mark these facilities on your map, but only the ones in areas where you're likely to be when disaster happens. Next, we're going to identify and mark down choke points. You're going to want to mark down choke points that could keep you from traveling between your work and house, or between your house and someone else's that you're likely to travel to, or between your house and your exit route from the city. What I mean by a choke point in this case is an area that's susceptible to traffic jams and likely to slow you down or stop you. You'll know many of these immediately from just your daily travels. What roads or intersections get backed up during the morning commute? How about the afternoon commute? Or on Fridays before a three-day weekend? And what stoplights take three cycles to get through? There's another category of choke points that will also be an issue in disaster situations, and those will be bridges and canyons, underpasses, overpasses, where an accident will shut down all traffic, places where the number of lanes of traffic goes down, and construction areas. On a personal note, sometimes when my son can't sleep, we go driving around the city until he does. On one such night, I decided to drive one of our routes out of the city to see if there was anything new to be aware of. I was more than a little surprised to see a big stretch of it was under construction and was now one lane instead of three. Now, construction choke points are short term, so I wouldn't mark them on your map unless you want to buy a new map every 6 or 12 months, but it's good to be aware of them. You also want to be aware of military installations. In the event of a terrorist attack or civil unrest, it's very likely that the roads that go parallel to military installations will be closed to create an additional safety barrier. Today we're going to fill out a skills and weakness assessment so that you will know which survival skills you have, which ones you want to work on, and which ones you want to look for in other people. Take 10 minutes and fill out the skills assessment that's in the resource page for this lesson. Be as honest as possible with your self-assessment and make sure to fill out the last column. If you know multiple people who work for a particular skill, write them all down. These are people that you want to have a relationship with and have pre-planned with before a disaster happens. Don't worry, we'll be covering strategies for approaching these highly skilled people in a future chapter without compromising operational security. If you're really serious about this assessment, have somebody close to you assess your skills. If there's a big discrepancy between your rating and theirs, it could mean that you're overconfident or that you need to show them an example of what you can do. You're also going to fill out a basic supplies inventory. This will take you between 15 and 30 minutes, depending on whether or not you're able to do it all at one time or not. This is not a comprehensive survival list. It's an initial inventory of basic items that you should have for surviving in place in your house. Take a notepad and take a quick inventory of the following categories of items. And basically what you want to do is figure out what you can use to make or build fire, what you have to eat, what water sources you have, what fuel sources you have, how many batteries you have, what you've got in the way of trauma supplies, medicines, vitamins, prescriptions, and expiration dates. The inventory doesn't have to be exact, and I've got an example of it on the resource page. And it's not what I suggest that you have on hand. It's only an illustration of what you should write down so that you know where to start. You can also include ammo and other survival supplies that you have on hand, but again, this exercise is meant to cover the most basic items. Over the next few weeks, we'll go over what you eventually want to have on hand, what you want to have in your 72-hour kit, and the most cost-effective way to take care of it. If you currently have a 72-hour kit and you'd like me to evaluate the contents, send me an email with a list of the contents, preferably in a spreadsheet, to gobag@surviveinplace.com. I'll pick one entry each week and post the results so that you can see them. That's it for this week. To see the resource page for this lesson, please go to urbansurvivalplan.com/590.